The Guardian.
A special edition of the Guardian Books podcast to mark the death of Doris Lessing. Here's Claire Armitstead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer.
Doris Lessing was one of the most important novelists of her generation, and she outlived most of them. She grew up on her father's maize farm in pre-independent Zimbabwe, and her formal education stopped when she dropped out of boarding school at 13. At 15, she ran away from home. At 19, when she married for the first time, she had already had short stories published in magazines. After leaving her first husband and child, she married Gottfried Lessing, a leading member of Zimbabwe's Communist Party. She left the party in the 1950s and took off with one of her three sons for London, where her writing career truly blossomed. There were novels such as The Grass is Singing and The Golden Notebook, plays and libretti for opera for which she worked with Philip Glass. She's written more than 70 books. And so the awards started arriving in Britain, in Europe, and in the US. And finally, in 2007, she was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature.
We're photographing you. Have you heard the news?
No.
You've won the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Oh, crap.
How do you feel?
Good. It's been going on now for 30 years. One can get more excited. Okay. Thank you very much.
Good luck.
Well, a certain professor must have died.
Okay, now what have you got everything? Have you got your... Right. Well, I'm sure you'd like some uplifting remarks of some kind.
There are other people here, so I just...
Any kind of remarks? Just tell me what this prize means to you.
Well, it's been going, as I say, for 30 years. One can get more excited than one gets, you know.
But this is a recognition of your life's work.
Yes.
Right, which is different than, I know, some other prizes, like the Booker has come in for some criticism for being...
Which one?
The Booker, for being some sort of a horse race, whereas the Nobel Prize for Literature recognizes a life's work.
Well, so. There you are, you see, you're saying it all for me. Congratulations.
I'll ask you just one last question.
What?
Does it mean anything to win a prize? I mean, obviously you don't write books.
I've won all the prizes in Europe, every bloody one, so I'm delighted to win them all. It's a sort of a whole lot, okay? It's a royal flush.
But she never actually went to Stockholm to receive it and sent her publisher in her place. She did take great care to write a speech for him to read out. It described impoverished Africans scrabbling for any book to read. Books, she said, literally wrested from rubbish heaps and the detritus of the white man's world. She also spoke of the wasted potential of writers who would never be, all those voices unheard. That same year, she published another politically charged novel, The Cleft, about a world inhabited only by women, called Clefts, until men, or squirts, come along. She told Zan Brooks at the Hay Festival where that idea came from.
Around about 2 or 3 years ago, there was this idea that the basic human stock had been female and men came along after. And that really inspired me, the whole idea. I thought, first it seems to me perfectly obvious it must be so.
Why obvious?
Well, because women are sort of, I think, women are sort of settled and seated and they're... have a very good relationship with the universe. Well, I don't think men do. I think you're a thoroughly unsettled lot still.
and a naturally younger lot.
Well, they're much more like a younger species than... I mean, this is what's... I'm not saying this is good or bad, you understand. Mm. I just think that this is why women tend to be conservative on the whole, and, well, they're very practical.
People are kind of accusing you of peddling sort of gender stereotypes.
If you're going to have a whole lot of females sitting on the same seashore for thousands of years, they're bound to be rather slack and slow, like sloths, it seems to me. They need to be woken up a bit.
Do you see yourself as a basically conservative, settled person?
No.
So men are there to shake women up a bit?
I didn't say that, but they do. My feeling is that if this is true, evolution or whatever this person is, or creature or force that causes things to happen, decided that men would be a good idea and bring in a new kind of freshness and excitement.
I'm glad that you say that you don't see yourself as conservative, because looking back over your life, from your upbringing in Africa to coming to London, you seem to have led a very restless, very adventurous, very independent life.
Look, when I say that women are basically conservative, I'm not saying that every woman in the world is basically conservative. I think, as a tendency, I think that women are more settled and more conservative than men. I don't know why people get so upset so easily. First, people don't like words very often. They get upset by words like cleft and squirt and monsters. They get upset by words, which is quite extraordinary. They get upset by ideas.
Why is that extraordinary? For someone who has dealt in words all your life and knows the power of words probably better than practically anybody.
Because they react sometimes surprisingly. The word cleft, which after all comes from Queen Elizabeth I, is easy to tolerate after a bit. But the language I use about men tend to upset them. Not all of them.
How has writing changed your life, and what has it kind of given to you personally?
Everything, because you can't write a book without getting new ideas and new thoughts. I mean, this is one of the pleasures of writing. If you start a new book, one of the things I think is I'm going to be completely different at the end of it because I'll have all these new ideas and thoughts, which is true.
And because when you were in your early 20s, you were kind of married, you had two children, and then you kind of threw that all into to sort of chase after writing. That was what you did.
I gave it all up. At that time, I was a communist. The great new utopias that I was in love with. What idiots we were.
But isn't writing about achieving a certain utopia?
No.
It's not. It's not about questing after something.
No. It's something for somebody like me. It's something I have to do. I have to do it. I mean, otherwise I would go crazy. I mean, I think this is probably a very neurotic thing that I'm saying about myself. I cannot not write. That means that, there's something must be wrong with me.
The Guardian was lucky enough to have one more encounter with Doris Lessing that same year when she came to our review book club to discuss her most famous work of all, The Golden Notebook, published in 1962. John Mullen put it to her that it had not always received a friendly reception.
All kinds of rather extraordinary adjectives like balls breaker and man hater and so on. A lot of these reviews had. I was quite upset at the time. Well, I was very upset. So anyway, in both in America and here, it wasn't a totally smooth birth, believe me. But what has happened to the Golden Notebook is turning a sort of an old pussycat lying on the wall, like a, oh, hello, pussycat. And there's this story from, I was walking along Hampstead not so long ago, and there were a couple of girls, 15 or so, and they said, "Hi, Doris." "Oh, hi." "We're doing the Golden Notebook." "Wow." And up they went. But wait, you know, this used to be considered a difficult book, but they'd already gone. So this is these books have these strange...
What about the first sort of enthusiasts for it? I mean, did they react in the way that you'd expected? Because I know when you wrote an introduction later, I think in about the beginning of the 1970s to the Golden Notebook, some of the kind of praise for it seemed as out of kilter with the book as some of the criticisms.
Well, I had a lot of praise from special people. One was a man called Nicholas Tomlin, now dead, who took me out to a pub and said, "Don't take any notice of them," he said, but the critics, he knew I was feeling pretty sore, and so on. There were very... people in America, they supported the Golden Notebook. And so slowly it took 10 years for France and Germany to publish it, because they said it was too abrasive. And when they did publish it, it came right on and to the right time for the feminist movement. So it became a feminist Bible. And so this kind of thing has always happened to the Golden Notebook. It has not had a quiet life.
It's quite a sort of challenging book in the way that it's written and the structure of it. If you like, a conventional narrative about a woman and about her friend, and then interleaved with it, these four notebooks, all of them written in different ways. One of them itself a kind of novel within a novel about somebody who themselves is writing a novel. How did that arise? Why did you think that it had to be written like that?
Well, here I come up against a really serious difficulty, because the atmosphere of then and now are so different. The late 50s, if I say that the left, the entire left was reeling all over the world because, listen to this, Khrushchev's speech to the 20th Congress. Now, who has ever heard of it? Now, nobody knows about it. It was absolutely devastating, and I could write several books about it. Some of them were on the edge of fast. They were so extraordinary, the reactions. But what was happening was that everything seemed to be, it was the end of that long dream about communism being the future. That was what was ending. And people were absolutely shattered. This is what I was seeing. A whole lot of friends were committing suicide, taking to drink, taking to religion. It was a very, very frightening time. A lot have become gurus. It's very interesting how many ex-communists have become gurus. Just have a look, you'll see. Anna says, and the second sentence in the book is, as far as I can see, everything is cracking up. And this is what I thought the book was about, the cracking up, which we now can see so evidently. We're living in a culture that is cracking up completely. I wouldn't have to write the Golden Notebook now, I just have to say it. It's obvious. So I created a structure which, it was all in fragments, the whole book's in fragments. I even have doubles of some books, like Anna has a sort of double called Ella.
Yeah.
Everything is in bits. And I was rather proud of that. But the first reviewers didn't even notice my rather, I thought, admirable structure. No mention made of my, because they were complaining then as now that the novel is dead. You know, they always have to say this. The novel is flourishing all over the world, but no, the novel is dead. They were complaining they wanted more interesting novels. Well, I thought, whatever else, this is certainly an interesting novel. But they were much more interested in saying it was a man-hater. That was the first reviews. But then it got, then people started to like it. And now, as I say, it's a sort of classic. It's the most extraordinary thing. 50 years, and all this has happened. You have to go back to the Communist Party again and its dislike of novels and culture. I was listening to, had been ever since I've been anywhere on the left, the criticism of bourgeois literature. So I was reflecting that, the discontent with the novel, and it should be better or different or abolished or something else. And so all that is in Anna, or Ella as well.
A lot of the politics seem like sort of satire to me, and I thought that maybe when it was first published it wouldn't have seemed like satire, it would have seemed like kind of serious debate between kind of intelligent people, but it seemed kind of hilarious some of the time.
Yes, I know it seems hilarious. The whole of the Cold War can seem hilarious. Sometimes I try out anecdotes from the Cold War on the young. They usually fall about laughing. But we're talking about death, torture, imprisonment. It was so extreme. Now, there's just one thing that I have to say at this point, which one great difference between then and now is that we talked about everything at the top of our voices. Now, a lady from Cornwall, Jessica Mann, came to see me last week, the novelist, and she said, now she's talking about the same period, she said no one ever discussed anything, that if there was anything important, it was not mentioned, anything difficult was brushed under the carpet. Well, that was what she remembered. I remember people talking at the tops of their voices all the time about everything, including women, you see, the women, what used to be called the women question in the 18th and 19th century. The woman question was very, very much discussed, which is why it's the Golden Notebook. But the point is the discussion. No one does it now. And I miss it enormously. I miss the fact that then, if you went into a room full of comrades, in no time you'd be discussing the world problems. Everything. And now nobody talks about it or even thinks about anything. Now, it's gone. It's a culture that's gone. Of course, it was the most frightful self-importance because it was based on the fact that we had to do something about it. I mean, if there was, I don't know, revolution in Ecuador, by God, you discussed the revolution in Ecuador as if you had to do something, which is madness. But this is how we were. So this is what looks in the Golden Notebook ridiculous. It's how we were.
All the characters, even though they fight all the time and have sometimes disastrous relationships, they're all basically ideologically of the same party. And in a way, that makes it sort of seem, I suppose, quite claustrophobic, I thought.
Well, I suppose it was. I mean, when I first came to London, everybody was either a communist or had just ceased to be one. So if you went into a room, the debate would go on between comrades and only just ex-comrades. I mean, it was a very interesting, I have to tell you, it might sound ludicrous now, but it was rather interesting. But it's all gone, you see. The feeling of we were born to set the world to rights,
yeah,
is absolutely gone.
But the people she Anna debates with, argues with in the book, all have kind of really rather sort of dangerously ingenious ways of talking around them, don't they? I mean, and they're quite, that's sometimes quite sort of chilling, the ability of
well, that's how, yes, it was. And that's why this famous Khrushchev speech, which had such an effect, there were people who, as I say, took to drink and religion or whatever because their hearts were broken. There were also people who thought it didn't go far enough. What Khrushchev said was he confessed to some of Stalin's crime. There were people like me who were terribly disappointed because the crimes were so limited. You know, he would have said very much more because he now knew very much more about Stalin. So there were people who had been saying in the party to anyone who'd listen, it is not the capitalist press, comrades, it is the truth. But they wouldn't listen because they couldn't bear to listen. I have a problem with the Golden Notebook because I told you, it never crossed my mind when I was writing it that I was writing a feminist tract. Never came to my mind, which of course is what I had done. And that is because discussions about relations between the sexes have been meat and brick for years. Everyone talked about how things should be. And men should be like this, women should be like that, and all this kind of thing. So I was reporting. This is how people talked about. Now, of course, we have a thing called Metro Man, isn't it? I don't think we would have believed this, yeah, metrosexual man, us girls in the 50s, oh, because I think men were more macho in those days.
The ending. There's sort of two endings, in a way. There's the ending of the Golden Notebook, where Anna seems to have been sort of free to write novels again.
Well, she cracks up.
Yes.
So does the other bloke.
Yes. There's the actual ending, which is the last three women section, where Molly gets remarried to a businessman.
The
house in Hampstead, yes.
You see, that was,
yes,
then quite a...
Anna has an affair with her lodger.
She doesn't have an affair with,
yes,
her.
Yes, she does.
Hello, she...
This is the last section. Those kind of slightly, those ironical titles that you have for your Free Women section. There you are, Free Women 5. Molly gets married and Anna has an affair.
True. That's absolutely true. Well, this is a kind of Victorian style.
Yes, yeah, no, I know. But she does have an affair.
Well, Anna, well, okay.
She says she's not going to write anymore and she's beginning a job at a marriage...
Yeah, she's going to become a marriage guidance,
yeah,
counsellor. Now, I was really in advance of my time. You might have observed what has happened, that every second woman I know has become a guidance counsellor. It has supplanted the sewing machine.
I think quite a lot of enthusiastic readers have been perplexed by the ending, the fact that there are two endings. Are there's a right to be perplexed? I thought I'd been licensed by you to be quite dissatisfied with the idea of Anna
Well, of course, these two revolutionaries changing the world and God knows what. Yes. One goes off to become a marriage counsellor and the other goes off to marry a man with a house in Hampstead. If you contrast that with the tone of the rest of the book, it's a bit of a come down, isn't it?
Yes.
She ought to have been off as Rosa Luxemburg. Yeah.
Well, look, I should give...
If she was being consistent.
I should give everybody else a chance. So, anybody here?
It sounds like you're talking about wanting the perfect man and also the perfect world. And I don't think things have changed. I mean, John talks about how it feels a bit dated and that politics change and things change. And you yourself say that people aren't looking to change the world anymore, but... do you really feel that people have given up so much?
I don't think it's given up so much as not knowing what to do. Because don't forget that our lot knew exactly. Revolution was on, come the revolution, which used to be not altogether too much of a joke. But now people know that this is wrong and that is wrong and the other thing is wrong. What to do? This is what is wrong.
In the 40 years between the Golden Notebook and the Cleft,
have things improved?
But particularly in terms of the relationship between the sexes, in the relationships between men and women, I think.
Well, I think in our parts of the world they've improved enormously, but in parts of Africa, women are routinely raped and so on, and I don't necessarily think they've improved enormously in the Muslim world, from what one hears. So it's a question of where you are. But what I see now with young people, it's infinitely better than what our lot had. They're much better, more relaxed, more friendly. And men are much better. You'd never find our lot of men wheeling a baby out in a pushchair or going out with a baby clapped to their chest. Good God. Now it's an absolute matter of course. Nobody even notices. Yes, of course it's better.
Doris Lessing, described in the citation for her Nobel Prize in Literature as an epicist of the female experience, who with scepticism, fire and visionary power has subjected a divided civilization to scrutiny.
Great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.